Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage dermatologist, Dr. Peter Ernstrom. Why don't you join us as we discuss and answer your questions about skin cancer? You can reach us with your questions and comments. If you're in Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our new email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Peter Ernstrom is a board-certified dermatologist here in Anchorage. He's been here a number of years. He did a lot of his undergraduate training in back east at the University of Michigan and Cornell, then did an internship at the University of Pennsylvania before doing dermatology training at Yale University. He spent 9 years with the Air Force and then settled here in Alaska to our benefit. Peter, it's wonderful to have you back.
Good to be here.
So today we're going to talk about skin cancer, and let's do our usual thing about skin and start on the basics. And what's the purpose of this skin that we all have? And let's talk about cell types, because that may help us understand some of the cancers a little bit better.
The purpose of the skin. There's lots of purposes. I look at the skin as being the that barrier that protects your inside world from the outside world. That's its main function, is to essentially let things through that should get through and block out things that shouldn't. And when that barrier gets broken down or starts to function improperly, that's when we get into problems. The skin's also our identity to a great degree. It's what we see in one another when we say hello. And so it serves a lot of purposes. It also has, while it's we talk about it as being the largest organ in the body, it also has its own immune system, its own neural system, its own ability to regulate our temperature with its own circulation. So the skin does a lot. And as far as the types of cells, there's two layers in the skin, two main layers, the dermis, which is underneath the surface, and the epidermis, which is the surface. And there's lots of different cell types within those two layers, but those are the two main layers in the skin.
And most of the skin cancers we're talking about are occurring in this top layer?
Yes, that's correct. The most common form of skin cancer, basal cell carcinoma, there's over a million of them a year in the United States, is a cancer of a cell that's found in that superficial layer. Squamous cell carcinoma, the next most common, is also in that layer, and melanoma, the third most common and the one that we worry about the most, really, is a special cell type that's within that layer, at least initially.
The melanocyte.
The melanocyte, that's right.
And what's it hanging around for?
The melanocyte, there's about one out of 40 cells in that top layer of your skin is a melanocyte, and its job is to produce pigment and give you the inherent color that you have in your skin. And evolutionarily, depending on how close you and your relatives live to the equator, the more pigment that those melanocytes would put out. People that live way aways from the equator have probably the same number of melanocytes, but those melanocytes don't produce as much melanin packets, as much pigment. Hmm. And the pigment goes a long way to giving a little bit of protection to the sun and the exposure that you may get, and also obviously has a lot of sociologic meaning.
So there must be some benefit to not having melanin in your skin, or at least darker skin, if you go further north also then.
I think that's true. I don't know what that would be, but I'm not sure if it's that you don't have benefit or it's just not necessary. I mean, that'd be a tricky question to answer.
Well, vitamin D may have something to do with it.
It may have something to do with it.
All right.
the farther away that you get, the more vitamin D, although I don't think that melanin blocks vitamin D production, so.
All right. I thought the more darker complected people had less ability to make vitamin D.
Perhaps. I mean, I think that if you measured it in the laboratory, that would be the case. I'm not sure that physiologically it makes that much difference.
Okay. What I'd like to do is really focus on melanoma first. And so those who are listening, if you've got questions or comments, we'll take your calls on any skin cancer. But if you have questions about melanoma, that's where we're going to go first, and then maybe basal cell and squamous cell carcinoma if we've got some time at the end. Why would I want to do melanoma first, in your opinion? Why would I choose that?
I'll tell you why I chose it.
Okay, good.
To be very personal, I was a third year in medical school, and my father died of melanoma that year. And about 6 weeks after he died, I had a melanoma on my back. I had a 20-minute procedure and was cured of mine. And so a disease that was exactly the same disease, in fact, in people very closely related to one another, had two dramatically different outcomes. And those outcomes were based on the point of intervention into that disease. And that's what really got me hooked in doing it. The reason that we should spend time with melanoma is that it's a very serious disease. It's one that if you don't detect it early is really a very dangerous cancer to have. There's probably this year there will be somewhere around 130,000 melanomas that will be diagnosed in the United States. And about 10,000 of those people will die of that disease. So somewhere in the order of about 1 per minute in the United States, we're going to have a death from melanoma in the next year.
And many cancers, it said, if we catch them early enough, they're curable, particularly if they can be excised completely. Is that fair to say about melanoma?
That's very fair to say about melanoma. In fact, that is the ultimate treatment for melanoma. We don't know how to prevent melanoma other than to change behavior. And we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a bit. But we do know that if you catch melanoma early, if you identify a melanoma at its earliest stages, that it's you've got about a 99%+ survival rate from that cancer if you just excise it, just cut it out.
I think what I'd like to do is go into a little bit about how and why a melanoma may develop, and I want to do it by going back into something that I read in the recent book that's been so popular called The Emperor of All Maladies, where a doctor named Mukherjee had really traced the history of cancer and the science of understanding and treating cancer. And what I took out of the ending was, towards the end, is that the newest evidence is that most cancers are certainly a huge genetic component, multiple hits. That is, you know, it takes a long time for any cell to be able to just be able to grow uncontrolled. But then you've got to metastasize as a cancer. And then you also got to make your own blood supply. And our cells don't normally do that. So the implication is that it has multiple DNA changes that allow a potential cancer to finally really get to be a problem. Is that felt to be true of melanoma?
It is felt to be true of melanoma. And the multiple hit theory in melanoma, one probably needs some sort of a genetic predilection or ability to for those the DNA damage to lead to an immortal cell. But the difference, I think, perhaps with melanoma and some other cancers, is that the multiple hits, as far as we know, are multiple hits from the same vehicle, that is, from ultraviolet radiation or from some sort of a radiation source. And the thing about the melanocyte is most of your melanocytes are readily available to be hit by that source of energy over and over and over. So while it may be multiple hits, it's multiple hits from the same thing.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One. My guest today is Dr. Peter Ernstrom, an Anchorage dermatologist. He's also a specialist in Mohs surgery, if I'm pronouncing that right, which is a special kind of surgery involved with melanoma, which we'll get into later. If you've got questions or comments today, a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. So then a melanoma is this uncontrolled growth of melanocytes.
Correct. So, and when I talk to people about this cancer, the normal history of a cell, any cell in the body, includes being able to die and includes being able to shut yourself down. And if you lose, if a cell loses that ability, most of the time the body knows what to do with that cell and takes care of it. But a few of those will slip by, and eventually, if all the right cards fall into place, or in this case, if all the wrong cards fall into place, that cell can go on to become immortal.
So people don't, I guess the public doesn't think about that, but there is programmed cell death in all of our cells. Doesn't mean that it limits our longevity necessarily. It just means that certain cells are programmed to die and maybe replaced.
In fact, all of your cells, I've been replaced. I'm not the same material that I was 2 years ago. Oh. And so Soylent Green is
All right. So there are different types of melanoma.
There are different melanoma. All melanomas are cancers of melanocytes. Okay. There are different clinical types that we as clinicians will describe, and we try to describe those differences because sometimes if we can identify one of those that is much more likely to be very aggressive, if we can identify that early, we can be potentially helpful. Melanoma starts in just the epidermis, and if we catch a melanoma that whose cells are still confined within the epidermis, that's called an in situ melanoma. And this is, for all intents and purposes, 100% curable. You cut it out and you are done, and there is really no chance of those cells going on to metastasize. There are superficial spreading melanomas. These are melanomas that started in the epidermis, but now some of the cells have grown out of the epidermis and started to go down into the dermis. And then eventually, at some point, the one or some of those cells develop an ability to break away from their original site and then go inside the body, either through the lymph system or through the blood system, and then eventually set up shop elsewhere. And this is metastasis, and that they can set up shop early on in the local region and later on pretty much anywhere in the body.
Let's go ahead and take a call. Scott called in pretty quickly. I want to see what he has to ask us. Scott, you're on line one.
I've got a lot of moles. I usually surprise every new dermatologist I go to with just the amount I have generally on my back and on my legs. So I've had surgery all my life. I mean, for 40 years I've been having them excised. And I've seen just probably every different way to take them out. Is there any way of having a mole excised that's more effective than others?
No, there are lots of ways to. It's essentially effective if you remove the entire mole. When we're teaching people how to take moles off, there are lots of ways of doing it. There are things that we have to think about for cosmetic reasons, depending on where it is on the body. But pretty much any method that ensures that you get the entire mole that you're removing is as effective as any other method, and. It is that the reason for removing a mole is because for some reason we think that mole is abnormal. There's no good reason to just remove people's moles. In fact, for people who are very moley or who have had melanoma in the past, some years ago, 20, 30 years ago, a lot of people would start to just whittle away and just take all of their moles off, thinking that they were doing them some benefit. Well, it turns out that melanoma about 50% of the time arises in a pre-existing mole, but the other 50% of the time, it just shows up on day one as a melanoma. And there's even some evidence that the group of people that was studied who got all of their moles removed may have done worse, and that may be because they had a false sense of security over the person that was just coming in and having moles removed that were somewhat atypical. So there are lots of different thoughts that go into what method you use, but they all pretty much are as effective as one another if they remove the entire mole.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Is having multiple moles a risk factor? I certainly have patients who make a big point of letting me know they have multiple moles and want me to look at them. Is it a risk factor for any kind of skin cancer, and particularly, is it a risk factor for melanoma?
It definitely is a risk factor for melanoma. I don't really think that it's a known risk factor for other forms of skin cancer. When I try to decide how frequently, for example, I'm going to see a patient that I think is at risk for melanoma, I stratify these patients into risk categories. So my first risk category would be somebody who's already had a melanoma. Somebody who's had a melanoma has proven to the world that they've got everything that it takes to grow a melanoma, and that includes the genetics and the environmental factors, the sun exposure history, necessary to do it once. If you take those people, you've identified a group that is certainly capable of doing it again. And we know that if you've had a melanoma, you probably have about a 1 in 6 chance of growing another melanoma sometime in your life. So that's the first risk factor. The second one would be if you're a primary relative of somebody who's had melanoma. So either a parent of someone who has had melanoma, a child, or a sibling of someone who's had melanoma. And those people have an increased risk just statistically. And again, they're one of the risk factors certainly is genetics. So you've started to tease out some of the people who are at higher risk just because of their relatives. Beyond that, the next risk factor is probably sheer number of moles. We talk about people being sort of officially moley people if they've got more than 50 or 100 moles in their body, and there are people who have more than 1,000 moles on their body. We also, a risk factor, even if you don't have a whole bunch of moles, would be if the moles that you do have really don't fit into any category of normal. So atypical moles or people who have lots of different types of moles, different morphologies of moles, or if someone has had a biopsy in the past, and the mole came back as somewhat atypical. Now, a mole isn't classified as just good or bad. There's a whole continuum between a stone-cold normal mole and a melanoma. And the more that you have that are further along that continuum, the more risk that you probably have for melanoma in your lifetime.
Yeah, this is a question that you may not – nobody may know the answer. But when you started listing these risk factors, my mind went to screening people and – and then the next question is, well, what percentage of people who have melanoma would not fit into all three of those categories? You know, so what I'm looking at, is this a huge percentage of melanoma in these, or are we not really able to answer that?
I certainly have had patients who walk in, have no other moles on their body, and no relatives who have had melanoma, and they have a melanoma. So the positive predictive value of these factors is strong, but I don't think you can really talk about a strong negative predictive value of it.
All right. So the next logical question, or it's a dangerous thing to say, for me anyway, is probably what the hell are we looking at? What is it about moles that should draw attention of a patient to want it looked at other than just
it's hard for me to do, and I do this every day. Mm-hmm. We historically have talked about the ABCDs of atypical moles, and I'll go through those, although I'll do that with the caveat at the end that I don't think this is probably the most important way of doing it. But A is asymmetry, so a mole that's growing out in one direction preferentially over another is somewhat atypical. B is border. We like the border of a mole to be well-defined, something that sort of just diffuses into the surrounding skin and you can't quite tell where it starts or stops is somewhat atypical. C is color. So you'd like a mole to be one color rather than a whole bunch of different colors. If a mole has light brown and black and white and a little bit of red all mixed into it, that's atypical. And D is diameter. We talk about a mole being normal if it's less than 6 millimeters or the size of a pencil eraser in diameter. Having said all that, I have many people who have never had a melanoma and probably never will grow a melanoma whose moles all break all of those rules. And so it makes them kind of crazy to read that they need to worry if they have ABCD moles because all of their moles are that way. So I try and tell people that your real job is to look for the ugly duckling. Everybody has sort of a normal morphology. Almost everybody has a normal morphology for their moles. And if one mole on your body, even if it doesn't break any of those rules, just seems different than everything else, I find that that's a really a much stronger way of somebody being able to be vigilant over their own moles and kind of focus. And that mole, just because it is an ugly duckling, doesn't mean it's a melanoma, but at least you're not likely to miss the one that is either rapidly changing for some reason or whatever the reason may be that it's catching your eye. It's the ugly duckling rule tends to work a little bit better, I think.
What about the word change? Is that an important one too then? I mean, is it the ugly duckling that's changing or is it the mole that is changing? Is that an important prognostic?
Sure. I think that if you've got a mole that you've known all along has been one way and all of a sudden it's changing, it's right to get it checked out. Mm-hmm. Or something that's absolutely brand new and just doesn't seem like anything else is a good reason to get it checked out as well. And then as you age, if you're still getting new moles well into your 50s or 60s, while that's not unheard of, it starts to get less likely. And so those should be looked at as well. And one of the higher the risk factor groups for melanoma is elderly men. So men 60 years and older with any sort of moles that seem to be changing, it's right to get checked out. The two highest growth demographics in melanoma are men over 60 and women who are in their teenage years and 20s. Those probably can be looked at as the reasons for those are probably because of behavior.
Let's just briefly talk a little bit more about the epidemiology, and by that, that's a medical term for who, what, when, where, how, kind of. So who's getting melanoma, who is less likely age-wise, sex-wise, just, you know, race-wise, and so forth?
The fairer skinned you are, the more likely you are. Anybody can develop a melanoma, but certainly fair-skinned, green eyes, blue eyes, red hair are risk factors for developing melanoma. They're also risk factors for developing other forms of skin cancer. Risk factors as far as age goes, melanoma is the most common form of cancer in some young groups. So it's not common to get cancer when you're 20 years old, but if you do get cancer when you're 20 years old, it's most commonly melanoma. Mm. And girls, especially in that age group, are the incidence of melanoma, the number of cases that we're seeing per year, is going up every single year over the past 30 years at a greater rate than the rest of the populations. We're all of our rates of melanoma, every age group rate is going up, but some are going up faster than others. And we think that it's possible that, or even probable, that the tanning bed use in young girls and women in their 20s plays a big role in this.
Are there certain areas on the body that seem to be more prone to melanoma compared to others?
Yes, you can have a melanoma anywhere on the body, but sun-exposed areas are more common. The most common place in females is historically on the legs. The most common place in males is on the back, although the distributions on both males and females can include just about anywhere on the body.
I would, you know, so my mind again jumps, if it's on your back, you're at higher risk of not seeing the changes early versus on the legs. And so men have a higher mortality rate, or is it come to diagnosis later? Let me maybe change that. Or, you know, we don't know. I mean,
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I don't think that there is a big difference between mortality rates in males and females, with the exception that in elderly males, there are some more aggressive forms that can show up.
Okay. Bill, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes. I had been referred to a specialist at the Native Hospital, and he's one of the best on the planet. And I have a lot of respect for him, but I had them all. I used to be a sun worshiper in my 20s down in Hawaii and what have you. And then I had this mole on my leg, and at a glance, he diagnosed it and he said he could remove it, but it would just be cosmetic. And I didn't really want to waste his time. I said, well, you know, it's okay. If it's benign, that's all right. But it still kind of bothers me should it be biopsied, or should I be comfortable with that diagnosis? And I also would like to know, does beer drinking add new moles? I understand that yeast in the beer has an adverse effect in the body, but I don't know.
I'll take the second half before that. I can't think of a way other than potentially influencing your behavior when you drink more beer that you might do something more dangerous that could eventually lead to something. But I don't know of any other connection between skin cancer and beer. As to the first one, there are certainly characteristics of moles that a specialist can look at and often say this one doesn't need to go away. But I would always say that the patient has veto power. If you're worried about it, or if something about it has caught your eye, that's more important than my evaluation. And it really, if something about it has caught your eye and it's you just know something isn't right, then it should be biopsied. And
thank you.
That's the way that I look at it.
Thanks. Yep.
I'm hesitating about whether I should say anything about yeast. It just seems like yeast won't go away. what I would say is that all of us, every one of us, have yeast in our gastrointestinal tract, in our mouth, in our vaginas, if we're a woman. It's a ubiquitous, common, normally present organism that you cannot eradicate from your body. And although there is this large amount of concern, there's never been much evidence that it is a huge pathogen for most of us. I'd never heard about beer and melanoma either. But anyway, so that's my, I wish I hadn't said it, comment about yeast, but part of my reason for doing this is to try to stamp out some real misconceptions about how healthcare works. We are just about halfway through already. What I'd like to do at this point is take just a couple minutes or a minute for our normal break and remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752 and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue to take calls and emails as we discuss skin cancer with Anchorage dermatologist Dr. Peter Ernstrom. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Peter Ernstrom. He's an Anchorage dermatologist, and we're talking about skin cancer, preferentially melanoma at this point. But we'll take any calls about or emails about skin cancer, and you can email to those questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. And we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, so we won't be able to answer your questions. Peter, let's take a quick question by phone again. Laura, you're on line one.
Hi there. My question is actually about the squamous cell carcinoma. My husband was diagnosed a little over a year ago. He had a large spot on his lip, had it surgically removed, and when he got his stitches removed, they said the margins are clear. Since then, the guy who biopsied it and referred him to the surgeon has had him on a treatment. I don't know if I can pronounce this correctly. It's imiquimod cream, 5%?
Sure.
Twice a day, and his lip it gets really scabby and scary looking, and our guy, who I do trust and respect, has told us it's that there are loose cells and it's killing the cells, and he lets it scab up, and then he lets it heal, and then he puts him on the treatment again. Well, this last time, it just got real bad. His whole face hurt, and it woke him up. And is this something that we need to seek further counsel on?
There are many things that go into answering that question. So the it sounds to me as if what the physician is doing, he had a squamous cell carcinoma removed, and what the physician is thinking is that that's a sign that he has had sun damage to that area, which may leave cells behind that have a potential of going on to become another squamous cell carcinoma right. in that area. And the imiquimod is used. Imiquimod really doesn't do much other than flag the body's immune system to come and attack if it needs to. If you put imiquimod on the inside of your upper arm, for example, you're not likely to get any red, any crusting, any anything. So it really only reacts where there are cells to react to. And so getting a reaction isn't necessarily a bad thing. That having been said, though, if it's really very uncomfortable and not making a difference in a positive way in the long run based on that doctor's clinical evaluation, then something else may need to take place.
Okay, because he's been through, I guess, maybe four or five times now. This has been going on over months, and each time, and this time it was far worse than it's ever been.
It's unusual for it to be getting worse over time. Right. So that probably requires some further evaluation.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you taking my call. Thank you.
Sure, Lori. All right. You bet. Linda, you're on line one.
Hi. My question relates to trying to balance some UV exposure, which I've read is helpful for some conditions like acne or eczema or psoriasis, with still trying to have a healthy level of protection, both for, you know, aging and obviously cancer. And I can take my answer offline.
Okay, great question. Appreciate it.
It's a question that leads to a lot of controversies in my field. And it is true that even as a dermatologist, I use ultraviolet light as a treatment for some forms, rare forms of cancer even. So we use it as a treatment for psoriasis. We use it as a treatment for eczema. We also use it as a treatment for a type of lymphoma that's in the skin. But we do that with the knowledge that as we are using it, we are also putting that patient at risk for developing early aging and skin cancers. And we balance those risks with the known benefits that we can get from it. There is no known safe level of ultraviolet light exposure. So all ultraviolet light exposure, as far as we can tell, it leads to those factors that can cause cancer. If people want to know how to protect themselves from the cancer, it's easy. You do so by behaviors that don't change the color of your skin with your activities outdoors, and you don't use tanning beds. If you're trying to use the sun to treat skin conditions, then you have to do it knowing that you are taking on those risks of developing cancer in the long run. I like to tell people if we did our tanning or our ultraviolet light exposure on Monday and we got our skin cancers on Tuesday, most of us, the vast majority, would stop that behavior really fast. The problem is that there's a time delay between the cause and the effect. We know the cause is ultraviolet light exposure, for the effect being these skin cancers and early aging. It's just that there can be 10 years, 20 years, even 30 years between the cause and effect, and that allows us to come up with a lot of silly justifications for doing that behavior.
All right. So I was going to ask about risk factors. You've established UV, and I think it's UVB light. I don't remember if you said that or not. And that's the wavelength that causes tanning, is my understanding.
It's actually both UVB and UVA.
Okay.
Much more UVB. We know that UVB certainly leads to cancer. But UVA has been implicated in cancer and probably in melanoma more so than in squamous cell carcinoma or basal cell carcinoma. It's a secondary risk and not as serious as the UVB. But it's there.
So that UVB and A radiation is enough energy to cause changes in our genetic material, our DNA, to start the process. And yes, there may be other predisposing issues genetically, skin color-wise, number of melanocytes, factors we don't understand.
That's correct.
Is that the way to think about this?
Yes.
Now, before we came on the air, you talked about the risks that are established with tanning beds. And I think what you told me needs to be disseminated. What do we know about how the use of tanning beds increases the risk of melanoma?
We know that if you use tanning beds before age 35, that you increase your lifetime risk of developing melanoma by upwards of 75%. So you almost double your risk. In the United States, for example, the risk of developing a melanoma, if you're Caucasian in your lifetime, is about 1 in 60, right in that area. If you use tanning beds before age 35, your risk probably goes up to somewhere around 1 in 35 or so. So a 75% risk factor increase in developing a melanoma. The United States Health and Human Resources and the World Health Organization have both classified tanning beds and ultraviolet radiation in general as a known cancer-causing agent.
Do sunscreens either modify the risk in any way? I'll leave it open-ended like that.
I'll answer it the way that I talk to people about protecting themselves from the sun. So it really should be a three-pronged effort. The first and foremost, the most important thing is behavior modification. There's absolutely nothing you can smear on your skin that allows lying out in the sun or lying in a tanning bed to be safe. If you think of sun exposure is to skin cancer as smoking cigarettes is to lung cancer, well, putting on a sunscreen and lying out is like smoking a cigarette with a filter on it. You're still smoking the cigarette. And so really the behavior modification is the most important. Second is clothing. You can carry around your shade with you and do just about anything you want to do. You can camp, hike, fish, golf, swim, just about anything you want to do nowadays with clothing that is comfortable for the latitude on Earth that you're at and is protective of the sun. Wearing a hat with a brim goes a long way to protecting your face and your scalp. And then finally, for those few places that are not protected otherwise, putting on an SPF of 30 or so. And SPFs, once you get above about 15, you're blocking all of the radiation that you need to block. You want to look for something that says broad spectrum. That's going to block both the UVA and the UVB. UVA, while it may play a role in developing melanoma, plays a much bigger role in aging. And wrinkling is not a normal part of aging. Wrinkling is a part of sun exposure. So if you look at a 90-year-old's backside, there's not a lot of wrinkles. There may be some sagging, but there isn't any wrinkles. And so it's if you want to avoid wrinkling, if you want to avoid the appearance of aging, then protecting yourself from the sun is also very important.
A couple of emails now I'd like to try to get through. Here's one from a listener. It says, my father recently had an early melanoma discovered and completely excised. I've had a couple of dysplastic nevi removed as well as a basal cell area removed. I had quite a bit of sun damage as a child, have fair skin, and am moly. Other than six-month checks with my dermatologist and minimizing sun exposure, what else can I do to minimize my risk for melanoma?
Not much more other than checking yourself in the mirror occasionally. We tell people overall to check your birthday suit on your birthday. But if you have, you've described that you are at quite a bit higher risk than the general population, having a primary relative who's had melanoma and already having had both atypical moles and a different form of skin cancer. So it's important that even every couple of months you just look in the mirror and make sure that nothing's catching your eye. And if something is catching your eye, you don't need to know if it's good or bad. You just need to know you need to get it checked out.
Similar question is, how often should a doctor take a look at your moles, particularly if one on your back or a spot is someplace you can't see, if you develop one on your back where you can't see it?
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit before. It really depends on other risk factors. If that's the only risk factor, then maybe once a year, once every other year would be good. And different doctors have sort of different protocols for how frequently they're going to check patients. I really do it by putting people in risk groups. And if that's the only one, you're down my list and probably in the once-a-year category.
What is an actinic keratosis, and what relationship might it have to skin cancer?
An actinic keratosis is, we call it a precancer. It's really a sun-damaged squamous cell and one that is not doing its job exactly correctly. We, at the beginning of our conversation here, we talked about the skin being our barrier, protecting our inside world from the outside world. Well, when the function of those cells begins to break down, they don't do that very well. And so you can start to get some inflammation in an area because different proteins are getting through there, and you have water loss, which causes it to be somewhat crusty. And these are cells that are there that signify to me when I see a patient that this person has gotten plenty of sun and that they are at somewhat increased risk for developing skin cancers. And indeed, we know that probably somewhere in the range of 1 in 200 to 1 in 300 of those actinic keratoses will eventually go on to become a squamous cell carcinoma. So we have different methods to try and treat them. We don't know how to identify which one of those are going to go on, so we tend to try and treat most of them, either individually or topically in a sort of field sort of way.
Here's an interesting question for a couple of reasons. Dr. Ernstrom was telling me before the program he just got back from Brazil. And wouldn't you know it, I get an email from Brazil.
Okay.
Is it more common for people living in tropical countries to have skin cancers, and particularly melanoma?
It is, but it has to do with where your ancestors came from. So if you look at Australia, for example, that's a great natural experiment, or almost natural. We sent a lot of very fair-skinned people to the tropics and subtropics and have kept them there now for 200 to 300 years. And these people have a much higher incidence of skin cancer than their ancestors who were farther away from the equator. That having been said, if your ancestors grew up near the equator and you are originally from Uganda or the Congo, and all of your ancestors were, then your incidence of skin cancer is actually less. And that has to do with all of the evolutionary factors that go into who survived over time within those environments as far as the evolutionary pressures went.
A similar question just entered my mind. What if you were born and raised in Iceland or Anchorage and never left and never did tanning bed and so forth? Do we know enough to say that that is protective?
Yes, we do. So we know that the incidence of cancer within those groups with respect to their behavior and their travel is definitely lower. The farther away that you get from the equator, as long as you stay there for your life and don't expose yourself, the lower incidence you have.
Another email, is it true that dysplastic nevus moles are more likely to become melanomas? And let's describe dysplastic. You've used that term before, or somebody did, so let's make sure we understand what that means as well.
I talked about the continuum between an absolutely stone-cold normal mole and a melanoma. And along that continuum include lots of characteristics that are somewhat atypical. They're not exactly one or the other. And those moles that have those characteristics are given different names. They can be atypical nevi or atypical melanocytic proliferations or dysplastic nevi, Clark's nevi. There's lots of different names. They're all ways of trying to describe sort of the gray area between the endpoints on that continuum. And the more of those characteristics that a mole has, the more likely that we think we are identifying somebody who has increased risks for melanoma.
I had radiation, this writer says, I had radiation for breast cancer last year. Does that kind of radiation increase the risk for melanomas?
No, not for melanoma. I don't know is the answer. That's a very directed area that's getting radiation. It's radiation at it's an energy level different from the ultraviolet radiation, which can be both detrimental to the cells that you want to take away, but also can increase your risk for some cancers. Melanoma specifically, I don't know. Squamous cell carcinoma, yes. There is an increased risk for squamous cell carcinomas within radiation ports and probably basal cell carcinomas as well, depending on the type of radiation that was given. So that patients who have had radiation in the past, we tend to follow a little bit closer for both squamous cell and basal cell carcinomas.
All right. I've got two emails that get into this vitamin D issue. Here's the first one. My husband always gets on me for using sunscreen because he says I need to get the benefits of vitamin D from sunshine. Am I correct to continue using sunscreen each day? I have dysplastic moles, fair skin, fair and thin hair, and blue eyes. My dad had squamous and basal cell cancers. What do you think?
I think that you are correct and he is wrong. That's my view. That you can get your, it's true. If you go out and get ultraviolet light onto your skin, there's a one of the forms of vitamin D that you need will be produced. But we know now that we can get that vitamin D through either enriched foods or through a simple supplement, and getting it that way doesn't increase our risk of cancer. And so if I'm left with a choice between getting my vitamin D by risking cancer or getting my vitamin D without risking cancer, I choose the latter. So it's important we know that there are health benefits to getting the correct amount of vitamin D. Exactly what that amount is up for a large debate that rages as we speak. But I know you absolutely do not need to risk getting cancer to get adequate levels of vitamin D.
And the other email on this is somewhat similar. It says, what about the information out there that says 15 minutes of direct sunlight a day without sunscreen, in parentheses, can maximize our vitamin D levels and prevent some cancers? So in a sense, this is getting to what we talk about on this program a lot. There's always risk. There's risk of doing something. There's risk of not doing something. There's some arguments and evidence now that vitamin D at adequate levels is preventative. There's some evidence that at too high levels, your all-purpose, all-form death rate starts increasing. So there's too much of anything. And yet, as you say, we need some vitamin D, and you can get it without having to go out and get some sunlight exposure. So, comments.
Everything that you just said is a reiteration of what I was thinking before. I've been in medicine now 25 years or so, and there's always kind of the pill du jour that's going to cure us all. Vitamin C back in the 80s, then vitamin E, and now it's vitamin D. And in each case, anytime somebody tells me that anyone would be better off by taking X, whatever that one thing is, the hair on the back of my neck stands up. And I think that it is right to think about these questions, but really not safe and not the right way to go about it to think that more is always better. And it certainly we shouldn't be using vitamin D as a justification for behavior that we know causes cancer. And that's the way that I look at it.
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're getting into the latter parts of the program. I'm going to ask Dr. Ernstrom a little bit about treatment and diagnostic options here shortly. But if you've got questions or comments, we will try to get to your questions. Our local number 550-8433, 550-8433, our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's talk about diagnosis and treatment.
Diagnosis of melanoma is made under the microscope. I can see somebody who has a very atypical lesion on their skin, but I really don't know what the diagnosis is until we remove that and actually examine it under the microscope. And when we make the diagnosis of melanoma, again, along that continuum I talked about, if there are enough factors that really say this is not behaving the way it should and is very atypical, and we make that diagnosis, the most important aspect of that diagnosis at that point is exactly how thick that melanoma is. Realistically, it's actually the volume of the melanoma. So you can imagine the more cells you have that are cancer cells, the more likely it is that one of those will eventually break off and metastasize. And that's what we're really trying to prevent. The method that we estimate the volume of that is by looking at the thickness of the melanoma. And we know through many, many studies that all other factors being ignored, that thickness is a very predictive way of looking at how bad the melanoma is. And it's the way that we talk to patients then about what needs to be done and really what the statistics are for their melanoma and how dangerous it is for them.
Just a quick overview of the treatment options then.
So initially surgery for the primary melanoma, making sure that you get the entire primary, the entire original site of the melanoma removed. And that we do by cutting it out and by adding a little bit of what looks like normal skin from around it. How much normal skin we add or how big of a hole we make when we're cutting this out is based on the thickness of that melanoma. And then also based on the thickness is a decision that needs to be made of how much do we look for possible spread elsewhere in the body. If a melanoma is less than about 0.7 millimeters thick, so very, very thin, we cut it out and we then follow that patient throughout their life. If it's greater than 0.7 or in some circles greater than 1.0 millimeters, then we start to do some studies to look and see if the melanoma has already metastasized. And that can be done through a PET scan or through a lymph node examination. And really the treatment tree begins to expand from there depending on what you find.
How about what? Let's just talk briefly. Not a pleasant thing to talk about. What are the expectations today in successful cure of metastatic melanoma?
If the metastases, if those portions of the melanoma that have broken off remain in the original region, so if your original melanoma is on your right arm. And when we look, we find some lymph nodes that have melanoma in it underneath your right arm, but nowhere else in your body. Then statistically, that person has about a five-year survival rate of about 65%. So you take that whole group, and 65% of them will still be alive at 5 years. If the metastases have gone elsewhere, that is, they're outside the original region and they're distant to that region, it drops off fairly quickly to about 15%.
And you also mentioned before we came on the air, there's been some newspaper articles about some newer medications that are in the immune modulator group. Would you explain what medical science is doing now and what to treat these kinds of problems? And what do we mean by immune modulators? And perhaps mention these new drugs that people may have heard of.
About 40 to 60% of melanomas have a specific mutation in them to a molecule that's got a name, BRAF, B-R-A-F. And we now have two immune modulators, that is, two drugs that tell the immune system to behave in a specific way against those bad BRAF molecules. And for the first time in many years, we have some therapies to offer people with metastatic melanoma that affect their survival rate and do so in a positive way. It is, again, it's only for those people that have a melanoma with that BRAF mutation. And it is the effects, while statistically they look pretty dramatic and allow for big headlines within newspapers, are still small when it comes to the overall survival of a group of people with these diseases.
You mentioned earlier, and it's certainly an important part of our body, is that our skin, as well as our mucous membranes, which is kind of the inside of our body's exposure to the environment, the outside is the skin, has this elaborate ability to detect normal and abnormal cells and normal part of my body and somebody else's body's foreign proteins. That's our immune system. Out of curiosity, if we look at a biopsy of someone with melanoma, or let's just say any skin cancer, can you see evidence of the body's own immune response attempting to control that uncontrolled growth that's going on?
Yes, in lots of different ways. So in melanoma specifically, sometimes we see something called regression, where the original site of the melanoma, the body essentially takes care of. And in a very small group of people that are diagnosed with metastatic disease, if you can't find their original melanoma, that group actually has a slightly better five-year survival rate. And it may be that they are somewhat immunized against their own melanoma. We don't know that for certain. Another form of skin cancer that I can say yes to your question would be squamous cell carcinoma. In patients who have had kidney transplants or heart transplants and are on medications that suppress their immune system, we see a marked increase in the number of squamous cell carcinomas in those people, given their whatever their sun exposure had been. And from many other points of view, this is really because there's an ongoing immune surveillance that we all have against these abnormal cells. And if you begin to break that surveillance down, then these abnormal cells grow more likely into skin cancers.
We just have a couple of minutes, and I apologize for speeding things up here, but we got two more phone calls or emails I'd like to try to get. Is there an advantage to using sunblock that contains Parsol over others that just state it provides UVA and UVB protection?
No, Parsol is a good block, and it's one of the blocks that we know is both broad UVA and UVB, but there are many, and there are lots of different reasons for choosing the sunscreen that you want. Some people need to choose physical barriers, that is zinc and titanium, rather than some of the chemicals because of sensitivities they may have, but all of the broad spectrum blocks work fairly well.
And a final email, does skin cancer appear differently in darker complected people such as African Americans or Hispanic persons? So is it appear different? Does it behave differently is another question I'd like to throw in.
It can appear differently. It can be harder to find. You can imagine the amount of pigment and the distribution of pigment that someone has can play a big role in how easy it is to find the abnormal. If you're very moly, for example, finding that one abnormal tree in the forest of moles can be difficult. The same thing goes, the darker pigmented you are, the harder it is to find that darkly pigmented lesion, if that's what the melanoma looks like. The answer to your question is there is a difference in the distribution of melanomas. The melanomas, for example, on the fingertips and toes are more likely in African Americans, and they can be harder to diagnose for lots of different reasons.
All right. So we're coming up to the last minute or two, and I think instead of asking another question that we have to rush through, I'd like to ask you to just cautiously, calmly summarize the important bits of information that you'd like to make sure our listeners hear once again.
Sure. I think the most important thing to know is that ultraviolet light exposure does cause cancer, and that it is one of the, if not the most preventable risk factors for cancer that we know of. We all are looking for that magic way of protecting ourselves and living longer. And really, you can do so in a known way by protecting yourself from ultraviolet light exposure. That doesn't mean that you have to stay indoors for your life. You can do just about everything you want to do, except perhaps lie out in the sun, and do it by wearing clothing and some sunscreen in those areas that aren't covered by clothing, and do it safely and enjoy life.
All right. Peter, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us again.
It's my pleasure, Thad.
Dr. Peter Ernstrom is a dermatologist here in Anchorage. There's a link to his office on our website. You can go to alaskapublic.org/line1 and make a contact with his office if you want to learn some more. And there's some links at his office to other information. There's also links on our website to the Skin Cancer Foundation, the American Cancer Fund site on skin cancer, and the Melanoma Research Foundation. Next week, we're going to be back July 25th at 2 p.m. The next edition of Line 1 will feature state epidemiologist Dr. Paul Anderson and Joel McLaughlin. We're going to be discussing the state's Health Impact Assessment Program. It's a new program beginning to look at other ways that we might impact on Alaskans' health in a positive way. So please be sure and join us for that. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Speck engineered today's program and helped us with the phones and emails. Thanks for listening, especially to those who took the time to call and email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.